Hey everybody, welcome to the Brothers West. This is panel number one. An audio this time. It'll be like a laugh track. A sitcom, it's gonna be great. Quick introductions. Brothers West, you can hit us on Facebook. You can hit us on Facebook or hit us on brotherswest.com. You can watch us on YouTube. I can't imagine why anybody would want to stare at us and watch this, but I prefer the podcast method. I'm Greg Soule. I'm Texas. I'm the bald one, right? In the boy band, you always have the old guy. That's me. Andrew Cox, he didn't get to make it. He is the nicest guy with the worst jokes. It's like minor bad news, like the nuclear option, you know what I mean? It's just, Andrew Drift, coolest Kiwi I've ever met. He's got really tall hair. Texas, I would say he's reaching out to Jesus with that hair. It's amazing. Paul Mann notices those things. Thomas Kernak, Slovakian, right here. Usually the smartest guy in the room. I think he's the Slovakian robot built to make us all feel inadequate. Let's see, Tom Smith. I don't think anybody doesn't know Tom Smith already. There's not really much you can say. It would be terribly interesting. It's too bad he couldn't make it past the wall. Just go around. Mike Hamm at Chicago, called the mouth of the South. He's from Chicago, but that's how big his mouth is. JJ Boyd, nicest guy I've ever met. Swiss Army Knife, he's MacGyver, just without the mullet. His network empire is so big, you know, you get a pilot's license to be able to survey his kingdom. Let's see, Alex Hart from Oregon, right? He doesn't live up to the stairs, he doesn't ride a unicycle to work in hemp clothing. He only does it on the weekends to the vegan bakery. Just for fun. Justin Miller from Virginia, called the disappearing man. Every time you see him, he's about 20 pounds lighter and lighter. Eventually, you won't see him at all. And then you have Justin Wilson from Indiana. He's kind of a dad. He's grumpy, you know, but he loves you. No, he loves you. He only hits us because he loves us. So, guidelines for this talk. Micro-tick-related questions, please. We're at the MUM, right? Don't ask us any question that only Micro-tick would know. Don't ask anyone some features in the release. I don't know. And I don't think we should really speculate, because I love making stuff up. You guys have ever listened to the podcast. This one's going to be routing-ish related questions, right? If you have any sort of ish-like routing things, I don't want to necessarily limit it to just that, but we had to kind of pick a sphere for it to be in, a genre, if you will, on those. Now, please participate, ask us questions. I have a few locked and loaded, just in case, but it'll be more interesting if you guys actually ask us stuff, because I like being surprised, right? I want to keep these guys on my toes. And again, find us later, introduce yourselves, shake our hands, buy these guys alcoholic beverages, enjoy those. I hear they have these things called dispensaries here. I don't know if they're into that. I'm not. I'm just saying, just throwing it out there. That's it for the slides. So if anybody has any questions, raise your hand, scream them out. Any questions? I got some luck. This guy right here.
I'll start. With the title being Brothers Wisp, I want to make it Wisp-related to start. But if you guys could just name the one thing you would do different if you could go back in time. Machine.
1 hour silence. I will repeat the questions. So if you could go back in time, like at the very beginning of building your WISP, what would you have done differently? To be honest with you, I only did a WISP thing for a very short period. I help a lot of WISPs, so I probably know a few things that people usually go wrong with, but these guys are very WISP-centric, so I think, JJ, do you want to have any insight in that?
That's a difficult question, because no one likes to admit their failures or things that they would have done different, but I think I would use Micro-tick quite a bit sooner in my network. I would have gained a little bit more trust in the product a little quicker, because it's been a really good tool. It's like a, I don't know how many of you guys carry Leathermans or multi-tools with you every day. I know it's like a critical tool, you know, that I carry. They strip me of it on the fly, but that's okay. But as far as what I would do different, I'd have to say that I would have probably gotten the contracts in place with Vertical Assets and got those squared away sooner instead of retroactively going back and trying to make things, you know, more bulletproof from a legal perspective. I think that that's what I would have done differently from an operational perspective. Anyone else?
I've had the opportunity of building a WISP, selling it, very bad acquisition, and then building right on top of the other WISP. So we have solved it before and after. The one thing I would do from the start is a whole lot better physical plant stuff. When you install on the towers, you know, fiber to the tower, better grounding, all that sort of stuff. Stuff at the layer, you know, zero and layer one type of situation. Just, you know, spend the money on proper mounts or towers, you know, all that sort of thing.
I would say, especially since this is a routing best practices, start out routing as soon as you can. Don't be afraid to talk to other WISPs, especially if you can find somebody out of your area. You don't really feel like, oh, I'm going to let out all my trade secrets or something. Find somebody that's a little bit farther down the road that you can talk to, and they'll help you out and get started. I think most companies, if you approach them, hey, I'm out of your area, I'm not here to compete, but I'd love a little bit of advice. I think most companies would be open to sharing.
Where do you think the best place to meet those folks would be?
Well, I mean, a place like this, right?
I mean, there's WISPA, right? That would you guys say that's a decent place to meet?
Mom and WISPA.
Yeah. I would say coming up with a naming convention, sticking to it, not changing it halfway through your development after a couple of years, and get all your text and label or state label stuff so you don't have a bunch of Cat 5 or Cat 6 wiring coming down your
one thing I would say is standardization is probably really good. Coming out of the gate, figure out how you're going to do every deployment, right? So think of yourself as like a franchise, like McDonald's, right? They want the exact same experience everywhere you go, and so they basically build a playbook for everything they're going to do. Every Big Mac is assembled the same way, it's cooked for the same amount of time, and the closer you can get the standard, the easier things are going to be, right? If you do a truck roll to a site, you're going to know what to expect. Right. If a tech's building a new anything, you know, here's the plan you follow. If you deviate, you'll really need to know why, and that should be documented. I think that would help out a ton of people. A lot of the consulting clients I get, the first thing I ask is, do you have a diagram? And the general answer is no. Right? people will say, well, I use the dude for my diagram. I say, well, if you have network problems, you can't say the dude, how you get a troubleshooting. Right? So you actually need pictures of the lines and IP addresses. It's kind of, that's the one thing I think a lot of us are bad at, because we're, I think if you're a WISP, you're a bit of a gunslinger, right? It's kind of like the Wild West, you know, you're rocking and rolling, you're throwing things up as fast as you can, sometimes you can really keep up, but you really shouldn't let process suffer too much, right? Wait until there's a little bit of lull and hurry up and catch up and let that stuff get behind you, because it will snowball quick.
Yeah, I would add, along the documentation lines, you know, you might be starting out as a one or two guy shop, but, you know, hopefully things go well. You're going to add other people. And having that documentation, I would say take a lot of pictures. Pictures explain a lot when you add a new guy and he's like, hey, I'm going to this tower. I don't know what I'm looking for. How do I get there? What do I do when I get there? What radios are? If you have pictures, you can sit down and explain that stuff. So documentation, pictures, goes a long way.
I think a lot of guys, when they first start out, they're doing an install every, what, 4 days, maybe? And then imagine once you get rocking and rolling and you're doing 200 installs a month, right? So the 4 day versus 200, if you don't have process and procedure, some kind of documentation system in there, then that's going to get away from you quick.
I would say one thing, especially in the beginning, and yeah, you're trying to just build up quick, and you know, you don't yet know how it will go, and it's actually lab things out. Take at least a little bit time to test things out in the lab before you roll it out to the field. Learn to do GMS, these days it really takes just like 5 minutes to put up a GNS server, import the MicroTik template in CHR, and off you go, and you can play with so many things, construct so many different topologies, play with routing, play with different things. It can really help to actually test things out before you roll them, especially in the early days when you are still experimenting, trying out what works for your network and what doesn't, etc. I think that would have helped me a lot.
What is GNS?
GNS is a network simulation software. It's free, open source, and you can actually run MicroTik completely for free because you can use the free CHR license, which is limited to 1 megabit. But for simulation and testing, it's all you need. So you just drag and drop 5 routers onto the map, connect them however you want, and you can configure and play, try how things work, try why they don't work, and not mess with your production network. Actually validate what you want to do before you actually deploy it into production.
One other thing, and I'm sure this is very near and dear to Thomas's heart, is find you a network management system and start learning to implement it immediately if you can. Otherwise, you're reactionary, right? If you're not trending bandwidth graphs, right? If you're not graphing things long term, how are you gonna know when it's time to upgrade? How are you gonna know when congestion is actually a problem or something else, right? It's something that's devices, you'd be amazed at how much just knowing that something stops responding will save you. Right? Don't always use your customers as your alerting system, right? If you can help it, sometimes they're the best. And sometimes, and I have some canaries, right? They're very sensitive customers in different places, right? Not just in kind of the wireless ISP stuff I do, but in like the enterprise environment, right? You have a couple of very sensitive application. Those guys watch those things very close. And so you can develop a very personal relationship with those guys. Sometimes they'll just call you as opposed to emailing you and your boss saying, hey, this thing's down, right? So it's usually good to flash a network management system. There's a ton of them out there. It's funny, nobody can sort of settle on any one. I mean, you just have to try a bunch and figure out which one works best for you.
I mean, I could talk about that for an hour, really. I could about monitoring and I'm known to talk a lot on that topic, but just get something, have something. You don't have to get it perfect the first time. Just have something. Don't assume things work. Have something that will tell you that things don't work. And what you really want to get into is you want to know when something doesn't work. You want to be notified that something is wrong. You don't want to actively be looking at it. You don't want to assume your network works, right? Your network should tell you when something doesn't work. If you don't get notifications, you should be sure that everything works. You can sleep at night much better. But at least start up with something. You don't have to have like a massive solution right at the beginning, but have something.
In addition to the monitoring, when something goes down and you find out that the equipment's failed, say it's a radio somewhere, having a backup of the last working config or any working config is a huge help in getting things back up faster. So once you're done setting something up, grab a quick backup, put that somewhere. Ideally, you're to the point where things are automatically backing up, but at least in the beginning that might seem like a lot. So grab a little backup before you leave the site, and then you have a place to roll back to. Maybe you can send somebody else the radio that's already got the config preloaded, and that's going to save you a lot of time.
Yeah, and if you can afford it, keep one on the shelf of everything. I know sometimes backhauls, that people assemble will cost $1,500, but say you get a strike. All of you guys in this room know it's not a question of if, it's when, right? Can you afford to have all those screaming people, right? Some people outsource their call center, and that's going to cost you money, right? As opposed to it's going to cost you some reputation. A lot of us, and a lot of you guys have competing WISPs in your area, and when you're a good WISP and there's a bad WISP, they sort of sully the whole wireless ISP industry name, right? People are a little reticent to jump back on it. So sometimes you have to really earn those customers. And if Resolution is pull something off the shelf, back up in 4 hours versus a day and a half when you had to do it overnighted and then try to source that from some vendor, it's just, for me, I prefer prefer to sleep a little easier.
Yes, sir.
I saw one of your podcasts where you touched on meta reviews, and I was wondering if you could explain some practical uses for MicroTik meta router.
For meta router
in production.
Right. Meta router in production. I have never used meta router in production. I just used it in a couple of lab scenarios to play with. I have seen some people, saw somebody running SIP server on meta router one time, the phone's connected to it. I'm not sure if they actually were using that in production or it was more just kind of a demo sort of model.
I got it. We have a very specific case for a meta router. We do a managed BTP service at several data centers. So these are customers who don't want to have their own router. They don't want to pay for physical rack space at the data center. So we brought up meta routers. That way every client has their own specific router where they can do their own BGP and things like that. It doesn't affect the other customers. That's really the only case I've ever had a real world, you know, scenario for one is I have all these multiple users that I don't want them to mess with each other. But I want to keep, you know, all of their filter rules, everything else separate. That's the only thing I've ever had.
I think in meta router too, whenever it said the router's kind of like you're going to do a reboot, I don't know that it issues kind of a graceful shutdown to the meta router underneath it. I'm not sure. At least I think that used to be the case. I'm not sure if it still is. So it was more of whenever, you know, if you're running a server in meta router, it was more kind of like a just power off sort of scenario for it, which is not necessarily good for a lazy machine. Is that more insight on that?
I just want to say, meta router is a powerful tool, but be careful not to overuse it. It makes sense sometimes, but it introduces a lot of complexity, a lot of cross dependencies, and a lot of abstraction. And sometimes it's not worth it. Sometimes it's better to actually physically separate those services and physically separate them. You know, each little thing has its own thing that it does, rather than having one big router, which then in meta router does many things. So if you want to use it, just be careful not to overuse it and overuse it and introduce more complexity, which is not really worth the benefit of saving. You know, sometimes you can just delegate one specific task to a little hex or something that's, you know, it's got almost no power draw. It's got enough power to do DHCP relay or whatever little task you want to use it. But I mean, the hex, the new ones that are like two core, four threads, they are extremely cheap and they have a lot of power. So be careful to keep proper, you know, service separation and the separation of concern. That's the principle that is very important to remember. So I'm not against it, but just, you know, make sure to not do it in a way that brings more problems.
Well, a question that popped in my head when Justin was talking about kind of a multi-tenancy, right? You have a router where you're running multiple instances for different customers. Compare that to running a hypervisor and then just spinning up a new VM for CHR for each one of those customers. I think I'm sure you'd get a better performance out of that, and then it gives you a little bit more flexibility if you're using a hypervisor. If you do need to run some network monitoring system, you just spin up a small VM, and again, the hypervisor will do more than a graceful shutdown in those sort of scenarios.
The only reason we didn't do a hypervisor was port density. We needed, you know, we needed lots of ports. So, you know, putting that into an x86 box or whatever was just, you know, it was easier to do a cloud core. But, you know, the hypervisor, I think, might be I don't know enough to talk about the meta router except for that, you know, the one case we've used. You know, I've tried to come up with scenarios where we could use it, but it's just, I'll just put in physical hardware or something like that.
Actually, I've used meta router on Asterisk for small customers, like five lines extensions, and it's working fine. I have it in like three places installed. Asterisk on meta router, and it's working fine.
So Asterisk on meta router is fairly successful in small deployments, right?
Yeah. Yes. But then I also have a question. I did ask, like, is it really the way I live for structure.
That's a good one.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
My network is down there, but within my wireless distribution network, it's a really critical to route there. I could just pitch and then only access the end users.
Okay.
I still route.
So the question's around bridging versus routing. Are you talking about at the tower, on the tower, routing?
I have let me break it down. I have like five towers.
Five towers.
Within, there are only two of me that clients end up connecting to, but because of distance, I have a few other repeaters in between, like, so within the repeaters and the final tower that the clients are connected to, do I really need to route within that infrastructure, my own infrastructure, not where the clients are connected?
Okay, so five towers, are they all interconnected?
Yeah.
All right, I'm gonna say it's route, if you can, right? If it's feasible for you to do routing, I would say routing. One, even if you're smaller and routing isn't necessarily critical at this point, what happens when you're ready to expand, right? As people tend to organically grow, it gets more difficult. The larger you are, the more difficult it is to move from a bridge into a routed infrastructure, right? Just more exit pains. If you start now and you're routing now, then that migration hopefully will follow a predictable path for you, right? You can kind of plan out what it's going to look like. And you can already be locked and ready to go. I think also if you want to add redundancy into a wireless network, you got to be routed, right? You're going to run into problems. You guys have to say about that?
I have to ring the monitoring bell again and the you know, troubleshooting bell again. It's so much easier to debug issues when it's routed. And especially it's so much easier to monitor where exactly in the path the issue is if it's a routed topology versus just a flat layer 2.
I'd like to add that with a routed infrastructure, as Greg touched on momentarily, was you have the ability to add the redundancy, so you can leverage OSPF if you have a loop in your network and that's created outside of a routing environment, you know, you could wipe out your whole network. Where if you're routing each tower or each access point off of each tower has its own subnet, you can do more creative things down the road, where you send specific traffics, like down specific links that you may have more or less capacity on, similar to the IP architect's presentation yesterday. It gives you a lot of flexibility. We had an instance where a customer brought online some new ASUS laptop that had a broken Ethernet port on it. It was just chattering and, you know, pouring some kind of disruptive traffic out on the network, and it wiped out that entire layer 2 segment. And if we had been completely bridged, then it would have been a much bigger event than just that one access point. So we, you know, basically did a MAC ACL and kicked them offline and brought the network back up. But it would have been a much larger event. And that's just one example of why bridging can get you in trouble. And as Thomas was saying, it gives you troubleshooting. Each layer 2 segment that's off of a tower, that's off of a separate routed subnet, is like another troubleshooting domain. You can look at them all uniquely, I think, Alex.
Yeah, so in that same scenario, if your entire network had been bridged, where would you have started to try and figure out where the problem was?
I wouldn't have known where.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't have a clue where to even begin. Where's this? It's segregated to just this one tower, so you go right there.
And I would say, again, that that's not an if, but when.
Yeah.
Or how many times. If you don't have routing in place, you're flying blind. You have no idea where the problem is. You're going to spend a lot more time trying to isolate the issue, and you might be creating a lot more problems in the process without having routing in place. I mean, customer calls up and says, "Hey, I have really high latency. You look at a ping." "Oh yeah, absolutely. If you have layer 2 and there are a couple towers down, like, you have no idea where that latency is being introduced. If you have routing, you can do a trace around and say, "Oh yeah, there's obviously a bad wireless link here." I've seen several times where you have one bad actor on the layer 2 network, and that's going to take the whole thing down. The smaller that domain is, then you can isolate those issues.
I think it also gives you a little bit more kung fu ability, right? If you're routing all these towers, you can do
things at the tower. If one individual customer and you want to do something very strange to them, I'm not saying anything malicious, right? You want to make a tunnel, or you want to policy-based route them out of some different direction, do something to them, gives you more flexibility to do that than if it was all just one big flat bridge network.
What would you guys say is the most effective solution for bringing layer 3 as close to the end user as possible?
What's the most effective solution for bringing layer 3 as close to the end user as possible? What do you guys have any thoughts on that? Is this, are we talking about DHCP versus PPPoE? Is that what you, shaking his head.
Regardless of any holy war discussions, the thing I always stress to everybody is having a managed router as close to the customer as you can, no matter, you know, if you're doing triple PoE to that router, if you're doing MPLS to that router, you know, whatever you're doing to that router, if you have control over what that customer directly plugs into, your life is going to be a whole lot better. You know, Greg was talking in his presentation yesterday about the little HAV lights. You know, you used to send those out like little children. And they're going to, you know, they're going to do what you need, but, you know, they're going to be flexible enough where you have that control over it. And in a modern network, the more control you have, the better.
No opinions. I don't weigh in. I think I've seen people successfully do it both ways, DHCP and PPPoE, right? You can do authentication with either. This sort of, this is a rabbit hole. Some people do authentication on their system. Some people manually add a customer. And there's no sort of mechanism on the back end. So if a customer doesn't pay, they have to manually go on the radio and turn off, right? Something like that. Whereas if you have an authentication system, it's a centralized point wherein if they don't pay their bill, you turn them off in that central portal, and then they cease to continue service, right? Something to that effect, right? So you do that with PPPoE, which is sort of tricky because that's a layer 2 protocol, right? They have to be layer 2 to get to the PPPoE server to do that authentication piece. If you're doing DHCP, it's going to be, I mean, they still have to be layer 2, and they're going to get an IP right there. It's potato. This guy's putting a hole in me. He hates PPPoE. I've seen people successfully do it both ways. I think try them both out, see which one works. I think there's a lot of capabilities in both of them. PPPoE has a lot of extensions that people don't necessarily know about that will accomplish a lot of what you're going to do. I think just try some stuff out, whatever your authentication system is. Maybe one or the other will work better for it. As Thomas said, try the lab. JJ's got some.
So PPPoE has worked out very well for us on doing /32s, and then we'll kind of say, okay, this segment of the network has this /27. That way we can aggregate those routes before OSPF. That way we're not distributing lots and lots of /32s into the backbone area of the network. We can, you know, aggregate those and then push them back into the backbone off of stub and not so stubby areas. So it's been a really good strategy to use all of our IPs with PPPoE. You know, we can use the network IPs that would usually fall on network boundaries and then broadcast IPs that would fall on broadcast boundaries because it's routed out as a /32 and the gateway is technically, I mean, you can set it to some arbitrary address. It doesn't matter. So it's a really good tool, and we kind of run a hybrid. We do it all. We do DHCP, we have statics, we have like mixed subnets. They'll have some of our infrastructure and some customer infrastructure. And then there's, you know, dynamic firewall rules that will, you know, keep the customers from accessing that. But I think it's not cut and dry, you know, whatever works and fits that hole in your network, use the tool that suits you the best. So I think this is the way, you know, to get layer 3 as close to the user as possible. Client isolation is really important for us on DHCP networks so we don't get rogue DHCP leaking back in off APs. There's a whole lot of tricks to make all of these things work best, and I think Justin has some input.
Yeah, I think
what I tell a lot of clients is part of it depends on their processes. Triple BOE is easy. It's a username and password. A tech can go out and be kind of autonomous and replace a broken unit really without much fanfare. If you're using a management software, you have to have a process in place that say you're doing DHCP or you're doing Mac-based Radius, where you know the Mac or the Radius server assigns DHCP. You know, that's a process. So I have folks who they're a one or two person shop, so they don't have the, you know, they just want to go out, get it replaced, document that they got it replaced, and just get the customer online. Triple BOE works for them because they don't, you know, they don't have to do anything really on the back end.
Yeah. And kind of to touch on what Jay was talking about, a /32 PBPOE, if I've only got /24 public IP addresses, I can take an individual IP and I can stick it on that client with a /32, which means that, you know, if you're a normal routing guy, you think, well, I have to have a, you know, a /30, so that I've got an IP here, an IP here, and I end up burning four. With PBPOE, there's one /32 here, and his next hop gateway doesn't even have to be in San Francisco, if that makes sense. I know it doesn't make sense, but that's how it works, right? So you can sort of, you can assign all of those /24s out to individual customers instead of having to actually physically assign it to an interface, burning broadcast network, and then one for your gateway. So
if you want to know how that works, Brian over here, you did a presentation, what, 2 years ago? So in the MUM archives, there's a presentation that Brian Horn here did on such things, if you want to learn how that works.
And it's, I think PBPOE is kind of tricky because if you're just a regular network guy, you've never been introduced to it, it kind of hurts your brain, sort of doesn't make sense at first. Thomas, again, the idea of labbing it, you don't have to have a crazy complex lab. You can do it with half lights, or you can do it virtualized. You can do it with VMware Player right on your laptop, and just kind of play with that, see what it actually does for you.
So yeah, I think it really is a holy war discussion that I'm going to make a stand here and make half the room angry.
Oh, it's a cool pen for me.
I'm not going to be looking for somebody wanting to fight me after the presentation. But I really for PBPOE. I really personally think it's so much better than the HCP on many levels. And yeah, so you are welcome to be angry at me. But what I'm trying to say here is that there is actually many designs you can do with PBPOE. PBPOE can be, you know, a single central server that you bring all your extended layer 2 to it through an overlay like EOIP or EBOS, etc. But it doesn't have to. Like, you can actually have distributed PBPOE servers around your network. And the important thing is they all have to be positioned against a single backend radius. But you can actually terminate the layer 3 very close to the customer, even with PBPOE. Nothing is stopping you from having individual PBPOE servers on the network, which are all connecting back to a single radius server, so it's still single AAA everywhere. And it's actually much easier to also have redundancy with this, since you can even have a really close PBPOE server to the customer, and another redundant one that's extended to an overlay somewhere else in the network. Like, this gets really complex. It just, you know, yes, you can do all those things with the HCP as well, but I think it's actually, when you talk about large-scale tricky things like this, like having multiple and multi-redundancy things, and you get into MPLS and V2S and all that, it gets really complex real fast. But it doesn't have to be that complex. And that's actually a little tangent I want to do. I'll start on a reverse tangent. Like, complexity and overlays and all of that. So, you know, a lot of people will tell you that, and it depends, but a lot of people will tell you that, you know, you should go OSPF right from the beginning. Yes, you should. But a lot of people will tell you you should go MPLS, VPLS right from the beginning. And here it depends, because when you are adding so much complexity and when you are adding such overlays, you can, and it can be beneficial in certain things, but you don't have to. Even PBPOE, you can have a network of 2,000 users, PBPOE, which is distributed without using MPLS, VPLS. You can. The question is that the right choice for your use case, for your architecture, for your design, etc. So what I want to get at is back to the labbing and to the testing. So if you are trying to decide if to do MPLE or PHCP, if to do an overlay, so if to introduce that complexity of MPLS, BBLS, or a different kind of an overlay network, you know, if you choose BBBOE, should you have a central one, or should you have multiple distributed ones, etc.? It's a complex discussion, and I remember when we started doing an ISB, all of these, like, so many questions, so many possibilities, what's better for us, what are the advantages and disadvantages of each approach, because there is many, you know, it's so much stuff. So I recommend just play with it, you know, it really, I have to go back to just put up GNS, drag five routers onto the map, or just, yeah, get two, you know, five HAPs, whatever, and just play with it, try it, experiment with it, see how it behaves, see, you know, apply it before you put it into production. Yeah.
So, we don't do single family homes, we do apartments and stuff. So, I've got a use case where we use both BBBOE and DHCP at the same time. We have a hotspot, so the person comes in, moves into the apartment, they plug in, and they typically get the hotspot page, and you know, sign for service and stuff like that. But some people bring in game systems and there's no web browser on or whatever. So we would use BBBOE to go basically dial under the hotspot with the username password that they fill in to get around that. So that's a very specific use case that we had that we used BBBOE and used it with. So
best of both worlds.
Best of both.
So to go back to Thomas' tangent really quick, he was talking about MPLS, BPLS. To me, it's the keep it simple, stupid sort of thing for me. So a lot of times when people ask me questions about, hey, I want to convert my network to MPLS, BPLS, it's a rabbit hole, right? MPLS basically changes the way you do routing decisions. It changes instead of normal sort of routing and route that you use labels. But then you layer on top of that another layer of complexity for BPLS. And that allows you to do layer two tunnels across a routed network infrastructure that's using MPLS, right? You kind of work hand in hand. This is a layman's close notes, quick version.
I'll have some pretty in-depth why you should do MPLS in my presentation.
So in my thinking, people come to me and they say, I've got 300 subscribers, I just picked up a business customer, they have two locations across the network, and they want to do a tunnel across, they want a connection, and I think I need to go BPLS, right? And so my thinking is, you need to overhaul your entire network with MPLS, one layer complexity. And then you're going to have to use BPLS to transport that across these two points. So not only do you have to re-engineer everything, but you have to understand how it works, all these additional complexities. And then anybody else that's ever going to touch your network needs to also understand that. So is it worth it doing that for that one customer, or can you create an EOIP tunnel like 2 minutes and call it a day, right? So it's sort of, I think, weigh your options. What's easier for you to maintain, your techs to maintain? I think MPLS and BPLS definitely has a place in a lot of people's networks. I just don't think it's most risks. They're smaller right out of the gate. I don't think that's really the right approach.
Yeah, and that's what I meant by, you know, the complexity. Be careful about it, because we all know that complexity can creep up so fast anyway. You can have so many things done on so many devices, and just be careful about it. It goes back even to the meta router. As I said, I'm not against it, just be careful for the use case. It goes as well for MPLS, BPLS. If you have a really small network, introducing all the additional complexity, all the additional layers and overlays and additional steps that you have to maintain, debug, understand, all of your other people that come and go will have to all of that. So just be careful about complexity. Complex solutions have a place. I'm not saying don't do them. I'm just saying actually decide if it's worth doing it for your use case. You know, don't just copy, like, here is how to set up MPLS, BPLS from some random website you find on Google, because that's going to come and bite you back, right? Complexity, I think complexity should be an enemy. I'm not saying don't do complex system. I'm saying, think about how to do it, if there is an easier way, if it maybe is worth it or not, you know, it depends. Always try to actually not just do stuff immediately, like, multi-BGP every single VPLS and my BGP and every single tower and stuff like that. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying think it is the right approach for you if all that complexity is worth it or not. And if you find out it, it is, yes, definitely do it. I mean, it's not the technologies and the solutions you see even here at the MUM. They all have their places, but just this goes back to what to do when I'm starting, when I'm small and still growing. Just be careful not to overcomplicate things. When you get to the point where you need all that complexity and you understand it and there's a place for it, then definitely do it. But yeah, don't make it as hard, like unnecessarily hard.
I think JJ gave me my mantra for 2017, and it's don't build pillars of knowledge. Yeah, don't make these crazy silos that are so complicated that nobody else is going to be able to maintain or support this. You are likely the only guy now, but at some point in the future, if you would like to not be the only guy, for the new network, probably make it as simple as you possibly can.
Have any comment?
No. Okay. This is a dear money.
To add, I'm not going to talk whether one thing's good or another, but everybody's talking about complexity and all this and layers, but I look at it from a standpoint of bridge versus router, right? It's easy to start bridge because you just start throwing stuff out there. So there's a really good reason to say, I need to sit down and learn this now and implement it so that as you do grow, you're not trying to go back and figure out how to do it again.
Oh, yeah. I think everybody will agree it's easier to start doing the right thing as opposed to go back, right? You know, paint your house the wrong color. You use the wrong shade. And, you know, your wife told you to get the right one and you just sort of fudge on the numbers. That would be terrible. Sir, I got too many people.
Go ahead. Speaking about complexity, what do you guys determine is kind of the best way for us to teach ourselves the theory behind these protocols to know when to implement them and how?
What's the best way to determine when to implement a protocol and how to do it? How do you teach yourself?
So, like, you know, learning the BGP, the MPLS, BPLS solutions, things like that, you know, I know how to do them. I guess I don't know when do I do them, why do I do them that way, things like that.
I'll say stuff that's slightly controversial, maybe. I love MikroTik's documentation, that they tell you what all the knobs are and what they do. They don't always tell you when to turn the knob, right? And they have so many knobs, sometimes you can get lost. For me, I think a lot of people learn in different ways, right? Some people are auditory. They need somebody to tell, they just sit to a class and get a lecture. I think there's a lot of really good training resources. There's a tremendous trainer sitting right here, if you want to go all over Slovakia, that is. And there's a lot of good trainers in this place. They're always pumping out new ones. So if you're that kind of learner, I have a lot of hubris, so there's nothing anybody can teach me, so I would never get that done. I'm a book sort of learner, so I like to just read through, and my education actually came through Cisco. All my stuff I learned the Cisco way, and then I found MikroTik later, and so that's where I got all my fundamentals. They're really good about teaching you how the knobs work, but then why you would use them in different ways. Of course, it's all history according to Cisco, so Cisco way and why to do it right, so it's not necessarily applicable to the rest of the world. That's sort of how I learned. I'm a book guy. Forums are pretty decent. I have some videos and stuff out there that's dated and bad, and I'm sick, and it's midnight, and there's a lot of coughing associated with it. It's really, man, I don't know if there's a bulletproof answer.
I mean, I'm one of these learners that I can really get it if it applies to my situation. So I learned BGP because I had to learn BGP. And the way I did that is, okay, this is what I gotta do. I have an understanding of kind of from reading and things like that. But then I started doing it, and then you progress through these levels. You're like, okay, I got BGP set up. I read something about setting up these filters. Okay, how somebody else did it. That's one of the ways I really learn is how do I apply it to what I'm doing, because then it's not abstract. It's, you know, this is what you're doing. You've got to get it done.
MPLS, vPLS, and sort of what it is capable of, but how do you know when is the time to implement it? Is that more or less?
Well, I can say I have to MPLS in my system now. But I mean, listening to these presentations is fantastic because it gives me a thousand ideas that I didn't even realize were possible with those types of solutions.
Being a WISP owner myself in previous lives, part of it comes down to a business decision. Hey, how much is this going to cost me to get to MPLS? What's going to be the, you know, the benefit? It's not necessarily, you know, from a truly technical standpoint. It's I'm going to have to put people hours toward this. I'm going to have, you know, possible service disruptions. I'm going to upgrade hardware. You know, is it really worth it for me in my, you know, 1 year, 3 year, 5 year plan? At what point does it make the business case? And that's what I tell a lot of clients is not necessarily technical, but you know, the business case.
Don't introduce complexities for complexity's sake. Understand what you're implementing. If you don't understand something, don't put it out there. Have a lab, play around with things, understand what there is, get familiar with them in a lab environment, play around. And I think you'll know when you need certain things, right? You're not going to be like, oh, I'm going to do B2B because that'll be fun, right? There's going to be some pressing need where you're like, oh, I think I'm at the point where I need B2B. Get familiar with it. And like I said earlier, talk to other people that are, you know, a little bit bigger.
You know, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm looking at these guys. If I have a question on when or how or why to implement things, we have a Slack channel that nobody else has access to, so I'll just throw it in there. I'll say, this is my problem. And literally, we've assembled JJ's a Swiss Army knife, Thomas the robot. He's really good with automation. And kind of, right, so you just assemble a team of people from varied backgrounds and all kinds of stuff, you know. And then, like, so we've got people that run the gamut top to bottom in that channel. And so, kind of developing a Rolodex of people in a, I don't know that, like, the microtip forums aren't necessarily, or any forums for that matter, aren't. I know there's really a section of, hey, here's a general, I've got this thing I'm trying to do. I'm not sure, is there? Do you guys know of any kind of open forums where you just sort of chuck out an idea?
Do you store reports?
Reddit? Is that where a lot of people go on there?
Well, part of it is, you know, people they don't trust themselves as much, so they're looking toward other people. And so when you start going on the forums, you have a, you know, I've learned over the years, don't trust what this guy says because he might be a fanboy, or don't this guy's, you know, he's off in my field. This guy knows what he's talking about, but it might not apply to me. So, you know, you filter yourself out and you align yourself with the people who are, you know, kind of your like philosophy.
Let's just say drop us an email. We answer emails.
Yeah.
I said, try to actually, like, expose yourself to as many different ideas and technologies and topologies and things as you can. Like, forums are really nice, but there's some super technical people that know very little things on the forums, and I'm sorry, but there's some people who are just bad at the forums. So just remember that any one single source is never a good idea, right? Get your information from multiple sources, ask multiple people about, because everybody will tell you, you know, it's like, lawyers, five lawyers in a room, six opinions, or what's the joke, right? And then five technical people in the room, 10 opinions, right? So
and they might be all right.
Yeah, exactly. They might be all right. So I think, like, how I prefer to teach, I just consume as much material as I can and then make up my mind. So, but that's for me, actually, like, reading. I read RFCs at a certain point in my life, which, yeah, it's, I don't know if you It's not a fun read. You don't do it for fun. So for me, what works is just consuming as much information and even colliding opinions. Like, yeah, DHCP versus BBBOE. You know, why trust me? I made the decision of BBBOE. Somebody else has made the decision of DHCP. We both have our reasons, right? We both like each the thing for our reasons. The fact that I like one and the other person likes the other, that doesn't mean anything to you necessarily. So my recommendation would be just try to get as much information on the topic, even conflicting opinions. Of course, don't trust any one particular person. Of course, check facts, like
also too, just understanding how something works isn't a good indication of when to use it. Case in point was Thomas's presentation, I think at the New Orleans MUM. He was doing DSCP marking, right? So as a packet comes in a switch, you can mark it with a DSCP code point, right? So you put a number on that, and that can traverse your network. He was actually making routing decisions based on that, whereas traditionally, you just use that for QoS. And it's like it broke my brain, right? Using something in a completely unconventional way.
Absolutely transformative for him and the environment he was using it, right? So just because I understand how something works, and you know, I can open a jar of pickles with a hammer, right? I may not need it, right? But it's like there's a lot of different ways you can implement these tools, and I would have never known about that if I didn't catch that presentation.
When is it appropriate to put filter, firewall filter rules on the main firewall filter versus bridges filtering on a bridge?
So bridge filtering versus regular firewall filtering?
Do you mean like the use layer free, use IP firewall for bridges? Or, so use IP firewall for bridges and there's this normal firewall in the hub?
If you're routing, there's your answer. You know, if you're running a routed network, you know, you don't even, that's not even a question. You know, if you have a specific case for bridging, and you want to, you know, keep DHCP from traversing those bridges, you want to, you know, keep broadcast traffic from, you know, trying to traverse those, you know, typically bridging is not what you want to do. So if you're doing routing, your firewall rules are, you know, not bridges.
Say, for example, it's a scenario where you are bridging. It's a use case that actually makes sense to bridge.
So I think I'm passing that. Yeah. Oh, I want to filter out.
Bridge filter, so use just regular bridge filter versus hitting the check block and go through the IP main firewall. You got any opinions on that?
Performance-wise, I think you're going to want to stick to the IP firewall as much as possible. I suppose there are some use cases where you need it on a bridge, but then I would just argue you really need a bridge in that situation.
Well, I mean, bridge filtering, that's going to be the only way you can block certain types of traffic, right?
I think like that one checkbox, it goes back to complexity, that one checkbox does so much, actually, that you might not realize and you don't know what it does. You guys know the packet flow diagram? Yeah? So if you actually look at the packet flow diagram and look what that checkbox does to the packet and how it influences the traversal of packets through the packet flow diagram, it's actually a huge change in how that packet is processed. And, you know, a layer to packet that goes through so many L3 facilities now, that I would argue, like, it's a question of, is it good to use this, or is it better to redesign that part of your system, to redesign that, to re-architect, to have a more transparent, clearer solution that uses more standardized methods of filtering rather than just hitting one checkbox that will do potentially so many things and probably in the future break so many things and you don't realize that layer 2 now traverses over all those layer 3 facilities. It's a very complex discussion, and I would recommend, rather than using that checkbox, redesigning your, you know, because I think most people use that checkbox as one magical thing that will just solve some arcane issue that I have, but I think redesigning around that is better than introducing that. And again, you will find, you know, nothing is universal, so this answer is not universal either. Yeah, like Alex said, you will find use cases where you need it, sure, but just be careful not to overuse.
All right, it's going to be the last comment over that time. What do you got, Miller? Bring it on, baby.
I had the suggestion for us to do a deep dive on the packet flow diagram stuff and really dig into that for one of our podcasts. I think everyone would probably really benefit from that, like taking specific examples of traffic and walking through it and discussing everything you know about it. So I think we really deep dive on that. I think that'd be great.
All right, let's put a bow on it in True Brothers West fashion. Miller, if people want to get a hold of you out in the real world.
I have a blog, dynastatic.net, dynastatic.net, and also True Brothers West Facebook
page. Actual. Alex Hart, how would you like people to get a hold of you if you want people to get a hold of you?
I would say hitting us up on our Brothers West Facebook or email.
that'll get passed along. It's a good action. Wilson?
I have a presentation in the afternoon. Come visit that. We do have one giveaway. So whoever can tell us what podcast number we're on. Who can tell us what podcast number we're on? 42.
One.
Panel one. Panel one.
We're on panel one, but what was the last podcast we did?
45. 57. I don't know.
Don't look. We're big. Yep, there you go. Who said 46?
Booyah. Winner. Winner, winner. All right, if you want people to get a hold of you in the real world, how do you do that?
NTIN.net, Mary Tango, India, Nancy.net. It's my main page.
It's actually spelled out, all those words. All right, Mr. Thomas Kernack, how do people get a hold of you in the real world?
Yeah, I'm fairly easy to find. Just Google for me. You can visit my YouTube channel. I've got tons of videos and presentations on there. I've got a presentation here as well. And mainly Unimus.net, Unimus for the English people. I've got a stand right next door, so if you want to talk to me, just come and visit me there. And yeah, just Facebook, YouTube, any social network. Yeah.
All right, sweet. Mr. J.J. Boyd, how do people get a hold of
it? The Brothers with Facebook is the best way to communicate with, I think, pretty much all of us.
Yeah, for sure. You can find me at gregsoul.com. I very rarely blog there. I have some old stuff that you can laugh at, partly.
Hey, thanks for that.
Facebook.com/TheBrothersWisp. Very responsive. All the content that gets pumped out is my camera. Sorry I wasn't here to annoy you guys in person like he does us constantly. If nothing else, send us emails, questions, comments, if you want stuff coming, thank you guys very much.